Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona, I realize we are continuing our series of unfortunate events, and this time we're talking about something. It looks like there's a pattern emerging, and perhaps it's not a good one. It's about denials. Is that right?
Oh, yes. This is not a nice topic, Mark, but you know, we have to deal with the not so nice stuff along with the exciting stuff, don't we?
Yeah, it's true. And the more we know, the better we can plan, right?
Well, yes, as well as the fact that we really want full disclosure for all of our listeners. And hopefully through full disclosure and through talking about some of the not so nice events, the unsavory matters, we can actually make a change. Well, that's the hope anyway. Mm-hmm. But yes, this episode is about discussing denials. And that we are seeing a pattern emerging, which is not pleasant at all. And for that, I have to say, I'm really excited that today on today's show, we have, of course, he's starting to become a super regular, John Pratt and Suzanne Lasicki.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, John, welcome back. You're becoming a regular on the show.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Mona, for the invitation again. And that now we are discussing really critical, important topics that deal with EB5 as well.
You know, Mark, the whole issue relating to denials is that it's really not expected, especially when there have been adjudications which have been out for 4 or 5 years, especially recently, because we have had the massive delays because of COVID and the change of government and all the staff issues that USCIS have had. The most recent quarterly report, which Suzanne's going to discuss right now, is indicative of a really unfortunate trend. Suzanne, what are you seeing?
Well, I have statistics in front of me, starting with I-526 for I-526 approval and denials going back to 2013. And looking at 2013 up to 2021, it's fairly consistent. It's around a 20% denial rate for I-526. And then in 2022, year to date, all of a sudden we have a 45% denial rate. Yeah. So that is quite alarming. And if you look at the quarterly numbers, it looks even more scary, starting from July 2021 with the regional center program shut down. The quarterly numbers for denial rates are 84%, 74%, 67%, 42%. So those are numbers that I look at, my eyes open, and I think, what is the story behind these numbers?
Well, you're looking at the numbers, Suzanne. I have to say that we are seeing the denials, not just some of the cases in our office, but in other offices, because we talk with other lawyers. It's happening. It's definitely happening. And what we are seeing, which you probably will see as well, that who's taking the direct hits, but some of these direct projects.
Right. And that is a thing that I think is important to note when we're looking at what is behind this trend. Why is it that all of a sudden, starting with the regional center program, we're looking at so many denials? And one thing we can conclude is that direct EB5 cases are being denied at a higher rate than regional center cases. Another thing to keep in mind is that when USCIS reports denials, it's actually a number that includes both denials and withdrawals. My estimate from an unpublished source is that they've actually accounted for about half of the denial numbers. So we're not only looking at USCIS adjudication standards for direct EB5, but also looking at the number of people who just gave up during the regional center program shutdown and withdrew their petitions.
So looking at this pattern and some of these denials, I know you've done a little bit of an analysis on what you've seen. What are you coming up with?
One interesting point that has come out in Freedom of Information Act data reported by IIUSA is that there is a country-specific denial factor.
Oh.
So, for example, South Korea has had a consistently high approval rate over the years, high 80s, 90%. China, where there's an interesting trend. They used to have a high approval rate for I-526. For example, as of FY 2016, 83% of Chinese I-526 were approved. In FY 20, it was only 54% of I-526 filed by Chinese were approved. And looking behind that, I'm assuming that there are, that's a, showing a trend in adjudications that is negative for Chinese I-526.
Yeah, we've seen that. And we've seen it both coming in, the RFEs are very strong now coming on the Chinese cases, but for both path of funds, especially for path of funds, but also on source of funds. And there was a trend amongst a lot of agents when if an agency had 8 or 9 or 10 or more cases, they would start repeating certain source of funds. And I think USCIS are picking up on that, and they're really wondering whether or not these are actually genuine or whether they're just something that the agencies themselves have manufactured. And I see that as what USCIS is looking at.
Looking at Administrative Appeals Office decisions or appeals for I-526, I noticed in the past 3 years, many of the decisions are focused on questions about path of funds, which is an issue that particularly affects Chinese. Is that something you see as a trend behind the increasing denial numbers?
Oh, yes. The RFEs have become much more difficult coming in on the path of funds.
Mona, are you seeing that more on China, or are you seeing that across other countries as well?
Well, you see, Mark, China is one of those countries where there is a restriction on the outflow of money. So any of the countries where there is this restriction, there are going to be more RFEs coming in.
More scrutiny?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me just add, though, that I think the issues on sources of funds, which is in some litigation that we were engaged in, is where the term complete path of funds first appeared to my knowledge, and where they talked about and what the complete path of funds is, how funds move and where they deposit and how they move from one account to another account. Because different societies and different countries have different ways of banking or tax returns, etc. USCIS has picked up on these differences. And countries where they all taxes or oral incomes is not reported on a tax return, and money's commingled, or they use currency swaps or different non-traditional money exchangers, etc., are being or are suffering from difficulties in overcoming some of these RFEs, etc. You know, we now know that the Fraud Detection National Security Unit has embedded officers within the IPO. We also know now that within that section, there's something called the CARP unit, which is a specific subsection of the Fraud Detection National Security. And they have been focusing on source of funds for national security and other issues. We also know that China and companies like Huawei have been receiving more scrutiny on the national security front. And my guess and what I've seen is obviously that they're focusing more on that front. And in discussions with a former adjudicator at the IPO, he said that in some cases, for example, you have the Fraud Detection National Security Unit, the FDNS officer, contacting an adjudicator and indicating that maybe the person has a degree in biochemistry from a certain university in China. Maybe some of the funds ended up in the Cayman Island, and funds like that could have been commingled with other type of funds. And the adjudicator, because he got this discussion from the FDNS officer, will then adjudicate it maybe in a more strong fashion than otherwise, because they were alerted by FDNS. So I think that some of these trends document what's been happening in source of funds. I think there are certain nationalities. I'm aware of certain cases in Ukraine and Russia. I'm aware of Chinese cases. I'm aware of Vietnamese cases in currency swaps that are being adjudicated in a completely different light.
Very interesting. And the other interesting thing, John, is I do think that the standard has changed a lot. I agree with you. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, we were working with an agent in China who came up with a very similar source of fund from, I would say, multiple investors. And it was a very unique source. But then it started replicating. And we were like, you can't have exactly the same source of funds for so many investors. It just did not make sense. Then when you go into the background of the investors, it looked like it was manufactured. And when we questioned, when we went back to them, they were indignant. They got upset with us. And we didn't have direct access to the client. That's the problem when you deal with agents in some of these countries. So I think that practice is going to have to stop. I think a lot of attorneys are going to have to talk one-on-one with the client, get a translator, and if they have to, an interpreter, and not go through the agent as much.
Right. But let me just add another thing. Another part of the problems that we've seen is when you get an RFE on a source of funds or an application that's pending for 4 years, and maybe the source of funds documentation on that I-526, which is pending for 4 years, is maybe 5 or 6 years old as well.
Yeah.
You know, 10 years after the fact to then now go back. I'm dealing with a case right now where someone got an inheritance in Latin America to acquire a parcel of land, and then it was sold. They now want to know when the inheritance was done, how the grandmother bought the property over 30 years ago. So they're asking for certain things that are just simply non-existent.
Yeah.
And I go back to this complete path of funds issue. In one of the litigations that we were engaged is the gentleman could prove that he earned the money, but he kept some cash because in his society, in the country where he was, he wanted to keep some cash. The government and the IPO said that that was a failure on the complete path of funds because $50,000 all suddenly appeared in a bank account, even though he could prove that he earned the money and he had sufficient income tax returns to earn it. But what they wanted to see is that it went from the company paying his wage to a bank account where it would accumulate.
Yeah.
So they're going into some evidentiary requirements that are clearly above and beyond what the regulations require, but they're asking for these complete path of funds issues.
Suzanne, you've put together a number of factors relating to your analysis of the data for denials. What are you seeing?
When I'm looking at denials, one way to think about it is whose fault was this? I think we can put denials into a few categories. One, it was the economy's fault. And this especially happens with direct EB-5. COVID-19 was very hard on small businesses, and a lot of EB-5 funded businesses just didn't make it due to economic issues. Some of them, I think you could say that it was the service provider's or lawyer's fault for putting together documents that really weren't approvable at the time of filing. And then a third category would be cases where USCIS is just applying standards that one could consider unreasonable.
But Suzanne, are you...
Yeah, I just wanted to push a little bit more on the that the lawyers made a mistake because it was not approval at the time of filing. That's a conclusion that the government reached in the denial. That doesn't mean that it was accurate or it is accurate just because they say so. And
John, there are a lot of standalone cases or direct pool cases which have been put together where, quite frankly, whoever's put them together has not understood some of the principles of EB-5.
I'm agreeing, Mona, but what I'm simply saying to you is that the government uses the standard of approval at the time of filing. And that is the absolute requirement for any type of visa, obviously, whether it's an H-1B or an EB-5. But just because the government says that it wasn't approval at the time of filing, it doesn't make it so. Now it may get denied for that basis. But in a lot of cases, and we've litigated a lot of cases, it was just that the government was incorrect in denying it under that criteria. And again, you know, their concept of material change, and I've deposed officers on what is the difference between a change and a material change, and they couldn't point it out. What's the difference between a change
Let me just add something here, John. Suzanne, you were saying that the economy has made a big difference, but I think also the very fact that there has been such a long processing time has played into the whole factor of direct EB-5 being picked up, because direct EB-5 is different from, say, a regional center project to build a hotel or to build a construction. It's operational. And by the very nature of operational projects, they're not straight lines. They evolve. So statistics change. Business plans change. Is that what you're seeing in your statistics?
the statistics don't show me that, but these particular cases that I have encountered with my clients and people that I hear about tell me that. One scenario that I'd like to run past John Pratt and hear if this is, hear his opinion on it. I worked on one case where the fact of the matter was that the investor put in the full amount of investment. It was spent by the business on acceptable uses, and it did create jobs. I looked at that and think this investor should be eligible. When the people who put together his I-526 package, they made a number of mistakes in the documents. There were inconsistencies in the business plan and so on. So when the RFD came, we had the problem that there were all those document problems in the I-526 filing. But still, the fact was the investment was really invested and spent. The jobs were created, and we showed that in RFE. They then went on and denied the case. And their reason was that what we presented in RFE was materially inconsistent with what was in the I-526.
Yeah.
And this is where I would push back a little bit, Suzanne. And obviously, because the appeals change. This is where we have succeeded in federal court litigation on challenging some of this, because what is the material part of the EB-5? Your money's properly spent and your money creates jobs. So there's a nexus between the job creation, and specifically in a direct investment, it's W-2 jobs. It's generally an I-9 W-2 full-time employment qualifying employee. So that there was a delay, or that the business changed from being a Mexican restaurant to an Italian restaurant, and all of these things, there were changes over the course of a period of years, doesn't invalidate the fact that the money was properly used and that it created the jobs. Now, the problem is, obviously, if the company's belly up by the time that the I-526 is being adjudicated. But again, I would push back that, was there a change? Yes. Is that a material change? And I think that, you know, the materiality in EB-5 is proper use of funds that are lawful and the creation of jobs. And in the direct investment is creation of qualifying jobs because they're identified, et cetera. So in those type of cases, if you do a very good RFE and your record is perfect and the agency still, you know, not convinced, then now you have to go through the AO, but litigation is a way to correct agency errors.
Well, before we get to that, John, I just wanted to bring out one more point here from Suzanne's work. Suzanne, you're seeing that there are more inconsistencies picked up by USCIS in direct pooled and direct projects. And these inconsistencies really are part of the fact that, you know, these are operational jobs. These are operational projects, rather, and factors change.
I think that especially over an extended period of time, as you mentioned, a business is going to develop in ways that are not exactly the way that was anticipated in the business plan.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Suzanne. For example, in some of the cases that I worked in, is they said, okay, your business plan said you were going to have 10 jobs and these were going to be the titles. You had 10 jobs, but these were the different titles. Or they got confused because you created the 10 positions, but we see that some of them were part-time, not understanding that there was a job sharing arrangement, and then you have to go through, work through all the I-9s, et cetera. So a lot of it is obviously on how robust the RFE response is and explaining these differences or these things. But that I file a direct investment and I say I'm going to create 10 jobs and there's going to be a receptionist and three secretaries and whatever, and I end that up with 10 jobs in a different way. Again, does that invalidate the EB-5? I would say no. And I would push back and say no, because you still created the 10 jobs. And if you could show that as you went along, that ultimately all the funds were properly used and all the jobs were created, then I think you could win it on an appeal. And if the agency is not willing, obviously in a federal court, you know, you may be able to have and we have a lot of success in challenging some in federal court in the past, and we'll continue to do so because the government sometimes is just absolutely incorrect.
I'll also say, John, the more experienced I get in this area, the older I get, the more I speak with officers, former IPO officers, etc., the more I'm understanding that the industry, USCIS, live in a bubble. A lot of their adjudicators are people who've been there for some period of time. There are very few who are experienced at 526s or understanding business principles. and they don't understand business operations. They find if the numbers aren't the same, then that's an inconsistency which leads to the business plan being not credible. Suzanne, Don, what do you think of that?
I completely agree. I mean, I completely agree with everything you said, Mona. But again, I think that part of the problem is the way that adjudications go, there's not a lot of drawback on a denial for the adjudicator in terms of his job security or anything. And they're not savvy. And I hate to go back to this deposition that we did. I did a Q&A with the officer saying, if I say it's 101 Main Street and I go out to 135 Main Street for my business, that change of address, is that a change or material change? They could not answer it. They basically said, we know when we see it, but they couldn't articulate what's the difference between a change, because it's called material change.
Yeah.
It's not called change. And materiality in different immigration contexts, and you know this, Mona, applies differently. In this case, it's job creation and investment of proper lawful funds. And I've said this in other speeches, that if I say I want to create a computer company and call it Apple, and then I end up many years later doing an iPhone, they will consider that to be a material change. That doesn't make it so. But again, this is where you have to have your record robust and perfect, and you have to have, because that's how you litigate. But once you have that record, then there could be litigation. Just because their ultimate conclusion says on a denial that either money was withdrawn. I mean, I've been on litigation, Mona and Suzanne, where they couldn't understand taxes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. We've had that too. You know, Suzanne, the other thing that I have noticed on some of these RFEs and denials is that USCIS seems to be suspicious of everything. And I don't know if that's because of what John has just said, that IPO is now full of fraud officers, but it seems like you are guilty until proven innocent.
Yes, that's just the expression that I was about to use there. Just as an example, I read an AAO decision for a hotel where the hotel was claiming a certain number of direct jobs. And as evidence that when asked whether that number was reasonable, they had their management company, who's a third party, write a letter saying, we manage these other hotels. This is consistent with employment at our other hotels. This number is reasonable. And in the denial, they said, no, that wasn't enough. This management company should have provided payroll records and tax filings for their other hotels to convince us that this was truly the reasonable number of jobs for this hotel. And also on source of funds, seeing the same thing. You prove that you earned a certain amount from your job. You prove that you pay taxes on that. You prove that you had the money in the bank, but they would say you had to prove that this money that you earned went into the bank and provided this bank balance. It looks like a very high standard of proof to me.
Yeah. I mean, John, are we seeing that? They've changed the proof?
Well, it's still the preponderance, but in some of the discussions I and with this former IPO officer, we're talking about the unreasonable. You know, it's not even beyond reasonable doubt. It's beyond unreasonable doubt. And I'll just go back to
like
in some of the
beyond unreasonable doubt.
So, you know, I'll just simply say what Suzanne said. If I can even prove that my salary is $500,000 and it went to my bank account, but my bank account had another $100,000 there parked before I got my $500. They want to know where the $100 came from and whether that was clean and whether my money was commingled with other money that was not 100% lawful. So they're using some standards that are just simply, it just doesn't happen in the real world. And I think that this goes back to my litigation hat. I'm now almost universally, Mona, using accountants to trace the path of funds on any new EB-5 that I get. Why? Because I want to have the backup of a reputable accounting firm to say, this is how the money moved. This is the source of the funds, et cetera. Because in one direct EB-5 project that I'm working on right now, the government concedes that he documented his $1 million. But 5 years have been going on since he's operating this business successfully. They then question subsequent post-approval. Another $4 million of his own money that he invested. So now they want to know the source of additional investments he made and other investments by other investors into his company. So now they want to know every cent that went into the company.
That's not preponderance of evidence at all.
I'm agreeing with you. And yeah. This is where you have to get creative in the sense that I'm thinking litigation, right? I'm thinking federal court. I'm in federal court at some point in front of a judge, and the judge hears from a KPMG or hears from a reputable accounting firm, and the accountant says, you know, what they're saying, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm thinking litigation. And in the eye to an eye context, I'm thinking litigation in front of a judge whereby I want to depose their accountant. I want to depose their how they came up with that evidence is reasonable. Just because they say it's not it's reasonable, it doesn't make it. So the only other point that I would like to say is this. They ask you on an RFE. You submit what they ask you. But the denial is criticizing you for submitting evidence that they did not even ask.
Right, so, right.
So to say that the lawyer failed, yeah, that happens a lot. There's a lot of bad work. But just because they say it was doesn't make it so. And again, I go back to these cases whereby they don't ask for it, but then the denial says you didn't provide it. And the regulations, the policy, nothing requires for you to submit that type of evidence.
Okay, this is really bringing me to an area which I'm feeling so strongly about. And I know Suzanne does too. Non-EB-5 SOFs, the source of funds from partners who are not EB-5 investors. Suzanne.
This really outrages me because it seems that it's specifically used to hassle direct EB-5 investors. Because if every individual investor, if his eligibility were contingent on the source of funds of every other investor in the NCE, if that was actually an eligibility issue, then regional center investors would also have to provide the source of funds for every other regional center investor in the NCE. And if one had a source of funds problem, every investor in that regional center NCE would have to be denied. But they don't apply that logic in the regional center context. They have just started to ask direct EB-5 investors to verify the source of funds for non-EB-5 investors in the NCE, which, of course, non-EB-5 investors are not happy to do. It's another thing that's not written in the policy. It's not written in the form. It just comes out in RFE and inconsistently in RFE. Is this something that's open for litigation?
I think it's definitely open for litigation, obviously, because, you know, and I love litigation. We've been doing litigation for a long, but it's not parting of the Red Sea either. It depends on which judge you get in which court. And one of the cases we're litigating is now pending before the judge. So it was a magistrate judge. And the magistrate judge accepted. You satisfy the regulations. You have evidence to satisfy the regulations. But the agency is not, it's not unreasonable to go above and beyond the regulations. And what I would say is, you're absolutely right, but you got to document a record. Because if I am not an EB-5 person, there's no way in hell I'm going to give you all this documentation just because you're in EB-5 context. Now, that to me has two problems. One is the guy that already existed will have to push back and put something in the record that why the evidence is unavailable. Because you want to put something in the record that the evidence is unavailable for a reason, not just that you didn't want to submit it. But in addition to that, now coming from a new investor, I'm warning people if they're doing direct investment and they're using other capital that, hey, you don't want to find out 4 years from now that they want to know all sources of funds. I'm just alerting you that they're doing that. You see these trends where you try to advise people, look, I would really like an accounting report of where your, you know, how your money moved and where it was parked and how you earned it and having the backup proof, because you may not get an RFE for 4 years. And I want to have that up front.
Yeah, well, that brings us to the fact that REIA, the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act, has now made the fact that, John, we cannot go directly to federal court and we have to go through AAO, the Administrative Appeals Unit. Suzanne, I found out recently that the adjudicators for AAO are the same adjudicators who are in the IPO and that it's not necessarily judges. So that really made me feel very good. But you read every single AAO decision, right? What are you seeing as far as the time they're taking to complete AAO decisions right now?
I would have 2 points to say on that. One is that they now, on the USCIS processing time page, they do have a report for Administrative Appeals Office where they tell you in the last quarter how many appeals did they decide and what was the time frame. They claim that for July to September, they issued decisions on 4 appeals and they were all within 180 days. So that's nice. Although we don't know how many were pending in the hopper that they didn't decide. I'm looking just at the text of an appeal decision that was published in August 22, and I can infer that the denial happened in 2021 and it was appealed in 21. So that one took at least a year to get through the system.
And let me ask you this, Suzanne. Do you have any statistics on the approval rate, meaning or the rate that the AAO overturns the USCIS decision, if any?
I do, and it's a very small number. Just looking at the past 2 years, in 2021, there were 44 appeals published. 6 of them were sustained or remanded. This year so far, 9 appeals published, 1 sustained, or actually 1 remanded.
So it would be accurate to say that they have about a 90% affirmance rate of the underlying denial. Let me ask you a separate question, because we have seen this in other contexts of immigration. We have seen whereby the original denial maybe had one basis for denial, but the AAO denial was even better, meaning was had additional basis for the denial, because the AAO
yes,
is not constrained.
I have noticed that.
The AAO is not constrained to simply affirm the basis of the denial of the USCIS original decision. They can tag on or add additional basis for the denial.
Wow. John, obviously, we're going to go to a federal court. Now, here's the issue, though. Right now, as Suzanne says, they're doing them very, very relatively quickly. But as we start seeing them fill up and we have some inside information, we know that there are very, very, very few, and I emphasize on the very, very, very few adjudicators within the AAO who even do EB-5. We're going to start seeing a delay in processing. And whereas for single individual candidates, it's obviously hardship, but now we're talking about projects being filled with hardship. We're talking about a lot of investors. What can we do?
Well, the problem that exists is obviously RIA mandated that an I-526 denial has to go through the administrative appeal process before you get to federal court.
And we all fought against that, by the way. We fought
Correct.
Very hard.
Because it was not mandated in the statute before. You could go to the Directory of Federal Court and bypass the AAO. Now you have to go through the AAO. I would, based on what I heard from Suzanne, though, we know that they decided 4 appeals in 180 days or less. We know that. But we don't know if there were 30 appeals pending when they decided those 4. So we don't, unless, Suzanne, if I'm wrong, if I heard you wrong, we don't know what percentage of actual pending appeals they decided within 180 days, because we don't know how many
That's was right.
the total pool of pending I-526 appeals at the time that they decided the 4. That's number one. Number two, because right now we sit in October, end of October of 2022, and the RIA changed the law mandating that I-526s have to go through the AAO. I would assume that the person that doesn't want to give up on the I-526 and wants to appeal it now has to go to the AAO. So I would assume that the percentage of appeals to the AAO is going to increase. What percentage will come out under 6 months, yet to be seen. The other thing that worries me about the AAO is sometimes you had decisions made by USCIS that were more easily challenged because the basis of the decision is what you appeal in federal court. Now the AAO gets a crack at it. Then they can add different bases for the denial, and then you get to appeal all the bases for the denial. One positive thing, though, Mona, is that you could add additional evidence. So if the record is not perfect, you can then add additional evidence to the AAO. And before, we would advise clients is file a motion to reopen or reconsider, because once you're in federal court, your record is frozen. You can't add any more evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another question we have for you, both Suzanne and I have for you, John. As we're seeing a pattern on the denials, not only in the actual standard not being adhered to, in the fact that they are asking negatives, in the fact that the adjudicators clearly are not following by some of the business principles or looking at the business conditions and are very sort of static in their approach, what is the possibility of, say, a bunch of pooled direct projects all coming together and doing a class action lawsuit?
Well, when you do a class action, like for example, when we did the loan proceeds class action, to certify the class, you know, there's different requirements for that, but it has to be on the exact same denial. Like in the loan proceeds, for example, everybody was getting denied because they used cash from an alleged loan that the parent or whomever got. So that was certified as a class. The problem that exists right now is that you would have to get the USCIS denial, the I-56, then you have to go to the AAO. Now, let's say everybody's getting denied at the AAO level. Could you try to do a class after? Because you have to have a final decision, which is appealable. Could you then try to certify it as a class? You know, off the top of my head right now, I don't see what the preclusion would be to try to do a class action once they have a final denial. But the final denial now is not the I-526, it's the AAO decision denying that I-526. But is it possible that you could still have class actions? I think it's entirely possible. You know, the same thing doesn't apply, though, in the I-29 context, because there, the appeal by law is a renewal. It's not even an appeal. It's a renewal of the I-29 in an immigration court proceeding. So, again, on the I-526, I think that class actions will be possible. In the I-29, I think they're a lot harder because each I-29 is renewed in a removal proceeding.
Hmm.
John, let me ask you a question. In RIA, when they say that no court shall have jurisdiction to review until the investor has exhausted all administrative appeals, what does that all administrative appeals mean? Does it just mean if they filed an appeal and it was denied, or do they have to then go on to file a motion to reopen after that and do a whole series before they can be considered to have exhausted all appeals?
Correct. That requirement in the I-526 context, Suzanne, is that they have to go through the AAO and exhaust that administrative appeal before they can go to federal court. In the I-29 context, when people have tried to challenge recently I-29 denials, and by the way, my firm litigated Chang a gazillion years ago, the only circuit court president in the Ninth Circuit on EB-5, and we overcame that. But to answer your question directly, what's an administrative appeal? You got to go at the I-526, you got to go to the AAO. In the I-29, they're going to force you to go to the immigration court, and you cannot go to federal court before you exhaust that administrative appeal. That is not a motion to reopen or reconsider. Now, historically, though, if you file a motion to reopen or reconsider, you don't have a final decision yet, and you have to have a final decision. So to answer your question directly, Suzanne, now in this context, if you have a denial, you could do a motion to reopen or reconsider, then you get a denial, then you could do an appeal, but there's other problems that are more technical, but the bottom line is this: before you can go to federal court now on an I-526, you will have to go through the AAO, in our opinion.
You know, John, we're EB-5 attorneys. We don't give up. So just because we've been thrown another challenge, which is now fight the AAO, I had in mind, and I know we have discussed this, is to go back to our friends on the Hill and request expedited processing for EB-5, because we are in a different category from the rest of the immigration world.
No, I completely agree, Mona. I mean, I think that if the requirement is obviously that you have to exhaust your administrative appeals through going through the AAO and the I-526 context, that an expedited processing within 6 months of your AAO appeal it's really warranted. In a direct investment, if your I-526 has been pending for 3 to 4 years, you do not want to be pending for an additional few years at the AAO, specifically because of the affirmance rates. It's almost a 90% rate that the AAO will affirm the denial. So if you're looking at a federal court challenge, you do not want to add another 1, 2 to 3 years of adjudication time in order to then have the opportunity to go to federal court at that point in time, because the reality of the matter, most direct entities will fail by that time. And unless the administration and the agency understands that EB-5 is a different type of petition and the expedite that AAO appeal, I'm just sure that they're doing a great disservice to the EB-5 industry if they just go through normal processing times.
Right. So here we have to go back to all of our methods, Mark, back to IIUSA, back to campaigning for the expedited AAOs. So stay tuned, folks. We are definitely going to be bringing this subject up again. Right, John?
Absolutely. And one important critical thing is that once the underlying petition, meaning the I-526, is denied, if there's a concurrent file adjustment of status application, while you go through the AO appeal, the I-485 can be denied. There is no stay of the I-485 pending the administrative appeal process. That's another very problematic area, because if the AO appeal process takes over 6 months, then the person could trigger a 3 or 10 year bar problem and face other legal problems to stay in the United States while even they're following on an appeal, a legitimate appeal on the I-526 denial. So, you know, expedited is critical, and expedited is beyond critical, is necessary for concurrent file I-526 with I-485s.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of human stories and sad stories because related to so many of these denials, because that USCIS has taken 4, 6, 5, 7 years to come up with the denials. People have moved over here. Children have aged out. Businesses have taken the money. There's just so many issues which USCIS just refused to look at. It's terribly unfair.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Mona. And it kind of comes full circle what we're saying. These denials are people, not just the petitioners themselves, but the families, as well as the projects they back and the American jobs that are relying on these projects to go through to better the economy. And with us facing a recession, now they're saying 100% it's happening. You know, now's not the time to really mess around with a lot of this project funding and the EB-5 and this job creation money that we need for America. Suzanne, John, what do you recommend going forward to prevent or at least mitigate some of these denials?
Proper representation, having the right team, and starting with a seasoned EB-5 practitioner is critical, and having the proper team to present the case and to build a record and properly respond to whether it's a request for evidence on a 17th denied is absolutely critical now, because the application has to be submitted with the right type of evidence to try to obtain a positive result.
And Suzanne?
I would reemphasize that to the extent that denial factors are within our control. I would say that's the most important thing that's within our control, just getting the paperwork done by people who have experience, because a number of the rules are unwritten rules. And the only way to know is if you're working with people who have done it before. Another factor for those of us who are service providers, just informing our clients as well as far as what's risky and what are issues that might come up, just so that they know to be prepared for it. Sometimes we don't want to give people bad news in advance, but in order to avoid a denial down the road, it's good to talk about those issues. And on the USCIS side, I would love to see processing times coming down, because the longer a petition stays pending, the more likely something is to happen that's going to make it result in a denial or withdrawal. And if we had timely processing, we wouldn't see businesses spend so long in that period when they can't have a material change.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Excellent points, both of you. Well, thank you very much. I'm sure we're going to be returning to this topic.
Yeah. Suzanne and John, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mona. Thank you, Suzanne. And thanks again, Mona, for highlighting some of these critical issues for the industry.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.